Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Suji DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Azure Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Basilik. All the rest of the co-hosts are off. I don't know, maybe they found warmer climates. This week, it's sort of cold and rainy down my way. This is episode number 512, and we're going to talk about WARA, which actually one of my first questions is I actually don't remember what WARA stands for, so we'll ask Cynth when he gets on. And recording this on January 27th in 2025. So a couple of announcements real quick before we get to Cynth. And these are all actually ones that, if you're using these, you should pay attention because the dates are coming up. But Azure RM, I've been doing it long enough when I remember when Azure RM was new, but Azure RM is reaching its retirement February 1st. And I'm actually not sure if the APIs will end up still working, but the PowerShell commandlet's certainly not supported at that point. TLS 1.1 continues to go away. Azure Automation will stop accepting connections for it in February. And then this one's not a retirement, but this is a cool feature. When we have storage outages, portions of the infrastructure at the storage layer, you have to wait for us to fail over. And so what we've added for ADLS and storage, if you're using the secure SFTP protocol, now you can trigger failover on your own. So if you don't want to wait for us to recover for whatever reason, and you're okay with whatever hasn't been replicated to the secondary location, you can certainly force that failover and bring your app up. Really good to think about, as you're looking at your disaster recovery plans, because we'll try and recover as fast as possible, but it's not always fast enough for any given workload. So on that, we'll get over to our special guest and our special topic today. So our guest today is Cynthurin Sivananthan. Cynth and I have been working, actually not this year, but last year we worked on some things together related to the architecture review work that we do within our Cloud Success, as well as that we publish on our content. Cynth, let's if you could introduce yourself and tell us what you do for Microsoft.
Yeah, happy to. Hey, everyone. I'm Cynthurin Sivananthan. I'm a chief architect within Global Customer Success. That role essentially means I got two major functions. I work with a lot of our customers. We do a lot of architecture reviews. We talk about new workloads or new projects that they want to work on, and then we help them through the process there. But then I also work on some of the internal work programs as well, just to make sure that our teams globally are equipped to help the customers, right? So this way we can scale to as many customers as possible. So I get dual function. It's been a fun ride.
It is. And you and I mostly got to hang out on when things are broken. Although, we got to hang out on a project where we were actually telling customers some, about our platform. But really, for the purposes of this conversation, we're really focused on your architecture stuff. So when we talk architecture, help me understand sort of what that means.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a few ways we look at architecture, right? And so the first one is sort of a logical view of all the different components and systems that needs to come together to make an application function so that it can do a business function for your customers, right? So so a logical architecture is sort of that left to right view of how data flows, how the systems communicate. So we look at that. And then we also then go in a little bit lower level and look at the how do those get deployed? What type of
so like infrastructure at that point?
Yeah, when you're talking the infrastructure. About that. Yeah. Exactly. Right. So we look at, VMs, PaaS services, and try to find that right mix so that it works for the customers. And like you said, right, we're looking at things like, retirement, making sure the customer's on a set of SKUs that aren't going to be retired or, notifications went out. We're helping them figure out availability zones and making sure that, workloads are actually using the availability zones in one or more regions. So those are all things we plan as part of that architecture conversation with customers. And the hope is that once they have that blueprint, they can then roll that into their dev environment all the way to production environment using some kind of automation tool, right? Whether that is Bicep or Terraform, you know, help out there as well to actually stamp out those environments.
And you know, I mean, you mentioned it, you know, you're working with customers, but the reality is there's not enough you or even of, you know, the rest of your teams to go around for everybody. So how do you, you know, how do you sort of help the broader customer base? Is this funneling things into design? Is this funneling things into best practices? Like y'all play in that area as well, right?
Yeah, we do, right? And it actually, I mean, we want to scale through our cloud architects at Microsoft, but we also want to make sure that information is widely available in our docs, right? And so when we find a proven practice that's been tested out with multiple customers and we're seeing success in that, we definitely put them into our internal documents so that it goes out to as many cloud solution architects as possible. But then we also translate them into our cloud adoption framework as well as well-architected framework so that information and that knowledge goes there, right? And by making that available there, we can sell, you know, we can allow each of our customers to self-serve. The reality is we can't be in every place, right? So if we're able to like help every single person know where it is, then at least they'll have a pointer to start from. And if they've got more questions, you know, they can definitely reach out to their counterparts at Microsoft and, you know, we're happy to help.
It is, you actually, I think you actually said the words in there. So we've got sort of two flavors of this. There's the well-architected review, which I think is where the WARA term comes from, and then the WAF, which is the well-architected framework. What's the difference between those two, and then how do they come together?
Yeah, it's a good question. So well-architected framework has actually five different pillars that you want to look at your workloads, right? It has reliability, security, cost optimization, operational excellence.
Oh, is it? That's a test for Monday morning to see if you can list them all off the top of your head.
I got it, I think. I think I got it. So yeah, I mean, there's five pillars in them. And the idea is to look at your workloads across all as many of those pillars as they make sense for your application, right? So sometimes you're looking at it through the lens of cost optimization because you want to reduce that cost so that you can take the savings for another application that you want to, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're looking at it from the performance efficiency point of view because you want to make sure, hey, I've got, you know, there is going to be an influx, right? Tax season's coming. So if you've got applications related to tax, right? You want to look at how performant is it? You want to look at it from the context of reliability, right, WARA, and make sure that the workloads can actually scale, right, at the same time be performant and secure. So these are all sort of ways to look at it. And so these five pillars gives you sort of laneways or runways to look through it. Now, how WARA or well-architected reliability assessment comes into play is that it is an assessment focused on the reliability pillar of well-architected.
Okay, so you're taking out of the five, you're sort of narrowing in on the reliability piece because that's, and you know this is actually where you and I, you know, first met, but that's actually where our customers and sort of struggle the most, right? Because it requires some knowledge about how the platform works, how it breaks, to decide sort of what are the best reliability approaches.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about when we deployed in you know, data centers, right, that we would have owned, right, when I was at in my other places, we gold plated quite a bit, right? We gold plated the hardware, we tried to gold plate
super
as much
expensive
of the,
everything
the,
yeah,
the tech stack all the way up, and then when you come to and then as a developer, and that was my background, is that I focus on the application, build the application as best as possible, log it, trace it, deploy it, and then it becomes someone else's responsibility to care and, you know, manage it, right? In cloud, the modality is different because as a developer, you're still doing the primary job of developing code and getting that to production. But you also have to think about how is that code going to be deployed because it's no longer the gold-plated infrastructure, right? You're able to mix and match IaaS or infrastructure as service and PaaS. So you want to have a good perspective across the tech stack now. And so that's where I think a lot of folks struggle, just to connect all the pieces together.
How much of this, you know, and this is going to get a little bit into sort of reliability in general, more than just WARA, but, you know, there's sort of a blend of capabilities that the platform brings on its own. So, you know, app services is itself deployed in a zone resilient, zone redundant fashion. But then there's other services like, you know, I think Redis has actually changed this behavior, but it used to be that Redis, you sort of had to opt into a zone redundant behavior. How what's the right way for customers to think about where do they take advantage of the platform capability versus where do they have to opt into some higher level of resiliency based on their application? How do they think through that?
Yeah, and so my recommendation always, and this is how I help the customers see through it, is when there is availability zones available in the region that they've picked, default to that automatically.
Just use it, right?
Like VNets, for example, spans AZ, so it's not that you're going to be spending more money by having the ability to use availability zones.
Right.
Now, the caveat is there is a round trip latency between the zones, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you want to make sure, and some applications like SAP are highly sensitive to some of that round trip latency, or even SQL workloads, right? Depending on the transaction throughput.
So
you have AZs to use, and that's your default stance. Now you put the lens of the workload, right? Mm-hmm. By using the AZs, are you going to penalize yourself elsewhere, like performance, right? And so those are the pieces to look through, and it's an application by application evaluation to make sure, right? That's one sort of
but it sounds like you're saying start with zone availability zones and then back off where you need to because of some very specific application thing versus historically people have started with I'm going to deploy it, you know, I'm not going to leverage zones, then I'm going to try and, you know, sort of get them in after the fact. And
that's right.
You know, that's sort of the wrong way to approach that, or less optimal way to approach it.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, we all know that when we, as we follow the safe deployment practices, right. And so when we roll out changes across these AZs, we roll those changes sequentially. Right. Because we know that customers are deploying their application, a front end or even a database across two or three zones. So taking, you know, an incident that takes down more than one zone causes a big disruption to customers. Right. And so we will definitely be rolling changes sequentially. And so by using AZs, they get that, you know, platform benefit of how we manage change as we get that across all the regions.
Okay. Great. Now, so we talked about sort of the infrastructure layer. Do y'all play at the application code layer as well? Like, you know, hey, you should have retry logic, or here's the best practice security design. Like, do you play at that level as well?
Yeah. And before we get to that application level, the middle layer also is, I think, very important, is PaaS services, a platform as a service. All those PaaS services, because what we are working towards, and I say working towards because not all Azure regions have availability zones, right? And so we're always going to be in that mixed mode for a while. But the idea is PaaS services will come with AZs, and so again, it's the same.
So you get it. Right? You sort of get it for free at that point. Plus you don't have all the management of an infrastructure service.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's the same question, right? So I was working with a customer who's using SQL managed instances, right? And it's a very complex, chatty application, which meant lots of transactions to the database. They couldn't use AZs because AZs actually increase the latency of the commits, right? And these have to be synchronous commits for the database. And therefore, they evaluated it, and then they backed out to a single zone regional deployment because that's the thing that made sense for them, right?
Yeah. And so they probably, do they end up doing, like it's some sort of active passive model where they have a separate SQL deployment, but they fail the entire app over at that point.
Exactly. Okay. So what they decide to do in their case is they do multi region, right? They asynchronously replicate their database to the other region. And then if there's any incidents with that database, they have a recovery path to get out, right? And they've tested those paths a whole bunch of times to make sure that it works really, really well.
That's a key piece is all this stuff. You got to test it, right? Because if you don't test
it,
who knows if it's actually going to work for you when it kicks in.
Exactly. Right. And so, testing is, I would say, above and beyond the most important thing. And it's not test once, test once for the, I guess, you know, checkbox, hey, we've done it before we went to production. But it's like, test often, as often as you can. And, you know, sometimes fail out of one region and run your application in the other region for a bit and make sure there aren't any gremlins, you know, hiding behind because there's a you know, configuration drift somewhere that you didn't catch, right? And so, yeah, test often. See if you can run out of your secondary region. If they need to be active-passive, ideally, if you can and you have workloads, try to run them active-active so you don't have to worry about DR, but that your application is able to handle that more gracefully. And then, Evan, to your question about application, application is critical, right? Like we went from gold plating things, right, all the way from hardware to the software stack. Now we have to think about, because we are composing more systems, right? Mm-hmm. So every communication from the application code to another system, we got to make sure there's retry policies. We're managing the throttling, right? So the famous 429s get thrown at you. You have to know how to handle those. You got to use queuing, right, to decouple your business logic, your application business logic from another system you may not even have control or purview into, right? So absolutely, there's cloud design patterns. There's a bunch of them, 30, 40 patterns, right? Not all of them are relevant for every app, but definitely put those in play because I think that gives you the ability to run your application gracefully, right? And I'll give you a quick example. E-commerce, right? You probably want your cart experience to be as resilient as possible, but maybe not the recommendations, right? Because there's one thing that makes you a lot of money and there's the other thing that will drive more into the cart, but then the customer has to decide. So, you know, you can still run an application, even parts of the application is degraded or down, right? Because your primary workflows, the money makers essentially are running as reliable as possible. So those application patterns play a role here.
And I think that gets into, I was going to ask you about, you know, when you talk about those five pillars, it feels like some of those are in direct conflict with each other, right? You know, if if I'm running the, you know, cheapest possible configuration, I'm probably not, you know, at the resiliency that I want it to be for my application. But it sounds like what you're just talking about there is that is how you make the balance, is instead of picking at the application layer, maybe you pick at the component layer within the application and say, hey, this piece you know, I can run sort of a cheaper configuration, but I'm okay if that goes down. This piece, my cart experience and the one you're talking about, like that can't go down. That always has to work. So I'm going to design it and scale it and whatnot differently.
Exactly. You spot on, right? And so it's not a one size fit all for the entire application. So it's definitely, it's very helpful to break it apart. And what I suggest is, do what's called failure mode analysis, right? Okay. Essentially, it's a what-if exercise. What if I turn off that service, right? Or what if I have a failure in the application, right? It's not always as an infrastructure or a PaaS outage. Yeah. There could be a bug in the application that caused a failure too. And so go through a set of failure mode analysis, essentially a what-ifs. Right? Once you know what your what-ifs are, I'll give you, I'll plug it in, right? We have the Chaos Studio, and you can use Chaos Studio to simulate those failure mode analysis to give it a shot and see how does your application react, right? Do you have an immediate outage? Do you get a, you know, server error immediately when one, you know, tertiary component is impacted or not, right? And then based on that, prioritize the workflows and then start adding resiliency, right? That doesn't mean you have to spend a lot of money. It could be code changes, adding retries, you know, caches, etc. But that gets you further down, right? And that and you do this incrementally, right? Do the analysis, and then do it again in a bit.
And that was the other piece I was going to ask is, you know, some of this stuff, you know, going from a SKU enabled to an availability zone enabled to a non-availability zone enabled, say Redis cache, might not be something that the application has to care about. But, you know, when you talk about adding retry or even adding a caching layer, right, that's application designs. And while, you know, everybody likes to talk about the ideal world of, hey, I'm building something from scratch, so I'm going to build it you know, sort of the best way. In practice, that rarely happens, right? Almost everybody is dealing with existing workloads that you're trying to boot. So how do you take that, you know, how do you start walking that path from what I have today, which in a lot of cases is probably lift and shift, which really doesn't do great. I mean, it'll run, but it's probably not going to run the way you want. How do you take that? How do you start that path or that journey from a lift and shift to something that actually is going to, you know, be stable and run the way that you want it to in the cloud?
A lot of road mapping with customers, right? And so I remember you know, as you talk about this, I remember a case we did this with a fintech a few years back, and they had a application that was making loads of you know, revenue for that company, you know, legacy, you know, classic ASP, ASP.NET.
Oh, they God, ASP. I haven't thought about ASP in years.
You got it, right? You know, massive SQL server, lots of, and it worked fantastic for on-prem. But when we start talking about modernizing into cloud, one of the things we have to look at is with the application, or what we did was, all right, what are the things that you want to achieve in cloud? What do you want? Right? What is the,
Why'd you go?
Sort of heart-to-heart conversation, really, and like, what are you trying to achieve here? And they talked about the cost of running big databases and then the risk of having one of those databases go down and the impact it could have to customers, right? Because the blast radius becomes big, right? And so we talked about that. We talked about, okay, what other new business they wanted to add. So they wanted to add some reporting and analytics and analysis. I'm like, okay, fantastic. So what we did was we came up with a laundry list of likes to have. We prioritized them. And then we started with the application layer. They had to make some changes in the databases and the app, like time zone, right? Can't use the time zone of your server. You got to use the time zone. You got to use UTC. That's a big change, right? And so We did that road mapping work. We knew what the change we had to do, and then we knew what the risks were because we can talk to the app devs like, hey, how do you do a time zone? We use the server time. Well, we got to change them, right? What type of collations you use? Like, how do you like? And so we did that, and then that roadmap really helped that customer just get into that headspace about modernizing. And you don't modernize everything on the day one of production. We did a lift and shift, but we modernized the databases, for example. And then over the period of a year, they started to slowly cut into their technical debt and then cut those out and then move more and more into PaaS. I believe they still have classic ASP running somewhere in there because it's probably one of those flows that doesn't get used often.
It's just not worth changing.
Exactly, right? It runs an ETL process or some kind of an extraction. Yeah. Let it run. It's okay, right? Yeah. But if you get an opportunity because you're trying to do something more different, right? More fancy or more specialized, that's the opportunity to refactor that into something more modern.
I think you hit on something right there that as somebody who lives in the support world, that is one of my pet peeves, right? Like you don't upgrade or change your code just to upgrade it and change it, right? Because this new shiny, new shiny library or new shiny language that's out there, you don't want to run around and upgrade just to do that, because all you're doing is you're introducing bugs that again, eventually you might get better because of that. But there's a pain period it takes whenever you'd make changes or migration, because we're humans and software has bugs in it. But you sort of pick and choose the pieces that you need to do. And if this part doesn't need it, just let it go. I mean, there's some support, challenges because nobody remembers the framework or whatever the case may be. But you're sort of not walking yourself into problems at that point.
No, exactly. Yeah. And when you build something new, that's also the opportunity, right? To say, okay, you know what? I'm building a new feature. I'm going to pick what's relevant today, right? And then reduce that technical toil. The other piece, the other lens also to look at is this application. Let's say I got some code that's been legacy for 5-10 years, but it has regular outage, right? It always needs somebody to go reboot it every couple of days, right? Because, it's a well-known thing, and a standard operating procedure for it.
Yeah.
It's probably an opportunity to fix it, because that's actually adding human toil, right? Yep. You need somebody else to remember to do this. And if they're not available, then you've got different problems, right? And again, sometimes it's not technical, sometimes it's non-technical, like toil, yep. that yep. drives change. And then that becomes the other opportunity.
Great. Yeah, no, this is great. So, as we wrap up, any last things about, well-architected resilience review with the well-architected framework that maybe we didn't hit on that you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah, a couple of things I'll leave it with. And I think these are critical to frame yourself in terms of how to run the analysis. You can always reach out to Microsoft for help, but I want to make sure that, you're able to self-serve, right? And be able to rationalize this among yourselves. So I think the first thing is non-functional requirements. Got to know your RPO, all right, recovery point objectives, RTO, recovery time objectives, your service level objectives. How long can your business take to recover, right? Which is the mean time to recovery, right? Mm-hmm. Those are all very important things to figure out first. Not every application is going to have the same non-functional requirements.
Yeah, exactly.
So know what they are, group them, right? Call them critical, non-critical, right? Mm-hmm. To make it simple here. Mm-hmm. But come up with those classifications, because what that allows you to do is take every application, put them into the bucket first, right?
Yeah.
And then once you have those buckets figured out, what we then do is do a bunch of analysis around, we talked about failure mode analysis, zonal analysis, what if a zone goes down? What happens to the application, so look into those. What if a region goes down? What happens to your application? How do you fail out, right?
Yep.
And then also, and a critical one is look at the outages that has impacted your application in the past 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And that doesn't mean just Azure outages.
I was going to say, that's application level stuff as well, I would assume.
That's application as well, yeah. Exactly, right? Look at it sort of holistically. Oh yeah, we've had these many outages, and some of them were caused by the application, some of them were caused by the platform, because that's going to give you an idea of where to prioritize, right?
Yeah.
And then once you have that prioritization, I would say, pick one scenario, right? One component, do the WARA, well-architected resiliency assessment, reliability assessments rather, and then from there, keep going forward, right? I think that's the best thing you can do. And the last thing I will say is don't forget your shared services, right? There's the firewalls, the DNS, the identity, right? They are essentially the connective tissue between your application and the rest of the world, right? Whether the world is internal or to the customers. So make sure you're also doing the analysis of those shared services with your teams.
Yeah, great. No, awesome. Well, we'll definitely, when we publish the show, we'll include some links to the public-facing content for everybody to check out. This is great, Senthi. Good to talk to you. Good to catch up, and I will try and keep WARA in my head. I know it's resiliency related or reliability.
Reliability.
Okay.
There you go.
I did a big search when you and I started the project on some of that internal content. I did a big search trying to figure out if reliability and resiliency are different.
Yeah.
In practice, they get used almost interchangeably.
It's all about how you're going to react to an outage, right? And how fast.
So. Exactly. Awesome. Well, great. Well, Seth, good to catch up with you again. Like I said, we'll get some links and we'll go from there. Great.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks.
See you later.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.